This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, galactic space geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. Galactic space geek Jeff is super excited as we are going into deep space today, and we are going to do something in space that I didn't have any idea how it was done.
Ooh, so this is something that Jeff doesn't know. Now I'm really curious. What problem are we solving today?
How do you measure the size and shape of a star?
How do you measure the size and shape of a star? Oh, I didn't know this either. This is going to be so much fun. Who is our guest today, Jeff?
Our guest today is the super smart and very cool Dr. Gerard Van Bell. And when you want information about astronomy, you go to the source. He works as the chief scientist for the Navy Precision Optical Interferometer at Lowell Observatory.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Gerard.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, Jeff.
Well, we are so excited to have you. You know, as Jeff said, we always love to talk about the stars, if you've listened to us at all. So you are an astronomer, and I mean, there's so many questions to ask, but I like to start with the beginning. Have you always loved looking into the stars since you were a kid?
I have. I always did. And I always thought that it'd be an interesting thing to go in and do work on something like that. But when I went to school, I figured nobody got a job doing that sort of thing. So
I remember having that same thought.
Yep. So what happened was I went to school and I thought I'd be an engineer. But while I was at school, then I took some astronomy courses and one thing led to another. And I was like, well, let's see if I can make this astronomy gig work. And 30 years on, it's still working.
I would say it's doing pretty well. Yes. 30 years on.
The funny part is the background that I have with doing the engineering first, or at least, you know, being engineering curious, was that I ended up doing a lot of astronomy engineering now in my job. I build telescopes and then I get to use them as well. So that's kind of fun.
So building telescopes, Do you mean, like, are you building what most of us think of as telescopes with either mirrors and lenses with the tube on a tripod? Or are you doing something completely different than that?
So I'm doing kind of, you know, the meta next level up from that, which is I will order things like that from people that make telescopes, and I'll take a bunch of them and I'll scatter them across the landscape, and then I'll build a single telescope out of the smaller telescopes.
Okay.
So it's mostly, you know, it's smoke and mirrors, mostly mirrors.
Wow.
I like
lots
that
and
answer.
Lots of mirrors.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this all connects back to this question that the question I've been trying to answer, which is, you know, how do you measure the size and shape of a star?
Right.
So when astronomers do these kind of things, they do them one of two ways. The first way is kind of the sloppy, easy way, which most astronomers use. Which
Why not?
Which is they will infer what a size is. And so what they'll do is they'll basically say, well, if a star is, if I look up at the sky and I see a star is a certain brightness.
Right.
And if I can tell if it's a hot star or a cool star, I can take those two bits of information and I can make a good guess as far as how big the star is. Because if the star is, let's say, really, really bright, then it's probably very close to us and it'll appear very large on the sky. And the most extreme example of that, of course, is the sun, which is really, really bright because it's really close. And what you could do is a neat little trick of just basically saying, okay, well, the next brightest star is about a million times fainter than the sun.
Okay.
And if I know how much further away it is, I can basically do a little bit of geometry, a little bit of math, and I can make a good guess as to how big it is. And so a lot of astronomers do that kind of thing of just making a guess. But
Okay.
But then there's people like me that actually want to go out and make the measurement and see how big it is. And so you go out and get a telescope. But here's where it gets a little tricky is because you get a telescope, a lot of times what happens is you look to the telescope and what you're looking at far away gets bigger. The telescope magnifies things. But the things that we're looking at, even the nearest stars, they're actually so tiny. They're still just points of light in the sky, even in the biggest telescopes out there for the most part.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So you need a bigger telescope.
Yes.
And you need a telescope that's about the size of a football field.
The lens has to be as big as a football field.
That's right. That's right.
Wow. But,
you know, you can't really afford that.
Oh, come on. That can't possibly be expensive, right?
You know, the biggest lenses are actually, we use mirrors rather than lenses now, but the biggest aperture, the biggest thing that you can get for a telescope nowadays, you know, is about the size of a basketball court.
Wow.
And, you know, you got to go from basketball court to football field, and you've just broken the bank, because even those, you know, even those things that are the size of the basketball court cost a lot of money.
Wow.
Well, and who knows if they could even engineer something that large.
Right.
That's right. And actually, this is an interesting, important point they bring up, Jeff, there is to make a mirror for these biggest telescopes that are the ones that you think of as a biggest single lens telescope. They've actually had to go to a place where you actually take smaller mirrors and you kind of tinker toy them together. You make you tile this up. So there's a big telescope in Hawaii called the Keck telescope. Is actually Keck too. And the mirror is about 30 feet across, but it is made of 36 hexagonal segments, 36 little pieces that tile together.
Oh.
Right. And the whole world is learning about this with the James Webb Space Telescope right now.
Same idea. That's right. The James Webb has half that number of things, but it's still tiled together. And they did that with James Webb because they had to stuff it inside of a rocket fairing to get up into space. And so
I have a question. Can I ask you this? Okay. So these tiles, are they all like segmented together to create one mirror? Or are they all twisted slightly so that they give different, you know, like angles?
So they all give their small little pieces of the same big mirror.
Okay.
And this was a big deal with Webb when they sent it up, because when they first kind of un-origamied it, you know, they have all these segments and they're all kind of pointing cattywampus because they've been shaken up like a snow globe on the way up into space.
Right.
And so they needed to align everything. And so, you know, it launched on Christmas Day of this past year, 2021, and they've had 6 months of commissioning work. And so the lead into that was, you know, each one of those segments had three little pistons on the backside so they can twist it around and get it pointing in the correct direction. So all the light from all the different tiles are all going at the same point.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
So you're talking about making one the size of a football field.
Yes.
That's down here on the surface of the Earth.
Yeah.
How are you translating that same concept down onto the surface of the Earth?
So I kind of cheat.
Why not?
Okay. Sure.
and here's how. It's all in the interest of science, of course. Which is, if you look at JWST or if you look at Keck and you see all these segments, one of the things you realize is that all the segments are aligned and they're all pointing to the same spot.
Okay.
You can actually go in and delete some of the segments, make them go away. And if you just leave the ones out at the edges, what you get is a very big mirror.
Right.
And it's less sensitive because it's not collecting as much light. A lot of the light's now just falling on the dirt between the segments you have left.
Right.
But you still get the resolution. You still get the ability to pick out fine detail in the sky. And so then the next thing we do is we just toss those segments in the back of our truck and we drive about half a football field that way and about half a football field that way. And we separate them really wide. And then we work very hard to bring the light back together again to the same point and snap the picture. And so this is where life gets interesting, is that you get all this resolution, but you buy yourself a lot of hurt because now you have to align things very carefully with all a bunch of mirrors in between.
How long does that take to align? I mean, assuming this is not like, 15 minutes. Okay, we're done. Right.
Well, once the facility has been built and it's running. So for us, for example, when we start at night, we spend about an hour aligning things, which is not bad because in the end, when we run during the night, there are some mirrors that are actually on carts that are rolling up and down rails that are doing more alignments in real time that are aligning to about 1 nanometer. And so 1 nanometer is about 10 atomic diameters. And we're doing that in real time.
Holy cow, wow. That's precise.
Yep.
Kids, you need to look up what an atomic diameter is. And
it's very small.
You need to look up what a comparison to 10 of those would be.
If you look at
he's talking really small.
Yeah.
If you look at a sheet of paper and you measure how thick a sheet of paper is, it's about, you know, it's about 10,000, 100,000 times thinner than that.
Oh my gosh.
Yep.
So then what does this precision allow you to see? Because we're talking about the size and the shape, right?
So now we have a telescope that's effectively, it's not actually a big piece of glass the size of a football field, but since we've got the pieces separated by a football field,
right.
We get the resolution. We get the ability to pick out detail on the sky. And so we are able to look at stars and we're able to actually see them as more than just points of light. It's like being able to, you know, I'm here in Flagstaff, Arizona at the Lowell Observatory, and it's like being able to look at an orange that is in New York City and being able to see the size of that orange.
Wow.
That is so cool.
Isn't that neat?
What a great comparison.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's because of this extreme magnification that we get that's, you know, 100 times or 1,000 times more than, say, what Hubble can do or Webb can do.
Right.
Wow.
So when I do sidewalk astronomy, I've got an 8 or a 10 inch telescope that I'm bringing out, you know, to a local parking lot or something, showing kids and families. I get asked a lot, and most of the time I'm looking at just the moon or the planets, and I get asked a lot to point it at a star.
Yep.
And I get a lot of disappointment when my 8 or 10 inch telescope doesn't change a pinpoint of light to a giant disc in my eyepiece.
That's right.
So what you're saying is that's what this size of a telescope is allowing you to do, correct?
That's absolutely right. Yep. That is the sort of size you need to make that kind of image. And so it's hard to haul out in the sidewalk, of course.
Yeah. Okay.
I would say so.
Yeah.
So first, I want to ask, can you tell us sort of the simple version of the mathematics on how you figure out what the size is?
Mm-hmm.
And then can you jump into how do you know the shape?
So the simple math on the size is once you've done all the hard engineering work to build this big, big synthetic telescope with smaller telescopes,
sure.
It really kind of falls out of the observation as far as you get a signal. And the weird thing is about the size of the signal, as you look at a star that presents itself on the sky that's bigger and bigger, that signal gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
Huh.
And so you just basically measure the size of that signal. And if it's a small one, you're like, oh, well, that's a big star. And if it's actually a big signal, you basically realize, oh, I'm still looking at something that is still a point of light. And so that could be, say, a star that happens to be very, very far away.
Right.
Right.
Even with this huge telescope, that is this, you know, size of a football field telescope, we still can only do this trick of measuring their sizes directly for the nearest stars. We're talking stars that are out to, say, 10 or 100 light years away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
okay.
If you think of the size of our galaxy, which is, you know, 100,000 to a million light years across.
Right.
It's really kind of looking on our doorstep.
Yeah, you're still in the neighborhood.
That's right. That's right.
Well, okay. So I have a question because we know why they've put the James Webb out in space is to get away from the atmosphere. Do you still have to deal with that with any type of telescope, even a really big one here on the Earth?
Yeah. So unfortunately, that's a big limitation for us, is that we have to look through the Earth's atmosphere. It's a lot like trying to see a quarter at the bottom of a swimming pool. These things that we're looking at kind of dance around. And each of the individual telescopes that I'm using to collect the light and then send it to the back end where we kind of knit it all together, each one of those is seeing the star kind of jiggle all about like it's, you know, a pea stuck in a bunch of jello. And so we have systems on board that actually will take the light from the star and it'll take some of the light, like let's say the blue light, and it'll track really fast on that light at the individual telescope. And then the red light, it'll then send along down the beam train to then be collected and combined with its cousins all over at the rest of the site. And so we do some tricks like that. But because the Earth's atmosphere is doing this, we actually have to track that light about 1,000 times a second. And this is a big limitation.
Wow.
It means we have to look at stuff that's very bright.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And we're doing these alignments over very, very long distances where, you know, we're throwing light, you know, about 100, 200, 300 feet where we're bouncing off of a mirror that, you know, is after the telescope. The telescope coughs up this, like I said, this red light, and you bounce off the mirror and you go way down a pipe to the back end where the laboratory is at. And the pipe, since when you have light traveling through air, it kind of gets beat up just like it.
Right.
So we actually have a window on the pipe on the front end and a window on the back end, and all the air in the pipe has been sucked out.
That makes sense.
And so
that
there's more engineering for you. So there's a lot of engineering for this kind of telescope. So.
Okay, I have one more question about this. All right, sure. So the atmosphere, does it matter if it's cloudy? I've always wondered that. Mm-hmm. Is it harder to see if it's cloudy and the weather and rain and whatever?
That's right. Yeah. You need it to be clear. You need it to be dry. Being dry helps. So this is one of the reasons why the facility I'm at is here in Arizona. Arizona is very dry. But I'm also here. We're here in northern Arizona. A lot of people think of Arizona as being kind of this hot cactus desert place. And the northern third of the state is nothing like that. We're trees and forests and big high plants. And we're up at about 7,000 feet. And so when you get up higher, you're at least making it a little bit better so that the air is a little bit stiller and it's not jiggling around as much.
Sure.
No. Yeah, we go to a lot of ends to put our telescopes in the right places. It's kind of important to do that.
Well, if it's that expensive, probably that's a good idea.
And thanks 128 years ago, Percival Lowell, for picking Flagstaff, Arizona for Lowell Observatory.
Good on him. Yeah, it's a good place. And it's a nice place to live, too. It's kind of fun, kind of nice little town.
I was fascinated on my first visit there that Flagstaff is nothing like where my parents retired, just south of Phoenix. Nothing like. Now, one of the coolest things, Dr. Van Bell, that I learned from you was that you were involved in figuring out the shape of a star. And
yes,
we haven't gotten to the shape yet.
Yeah. Yep.
And I've done reading on your work, and you and I talked about it a little bit, and I am still fascinated, like jaw-dropping in awe of, can you explain how you got the shape of something so far away?
So we've actually already done most of the hard work. So, and what we do is when you have, say, two telescopes that are being joined together to make a synthetic bigger telescope. It's a lot like, you know, if you draw a line from telescope one to telescope two, it's a lot like that forms a ruler that you're just kind of pasting up onto the sky.
And
if you can take that ruler and twist it around, you can measure the size of something in the sky in many different places across of its face. And so if it's, let's say it's shaped like a, you know, take a beach ball. And if you take that beach ball and you squeeze it in your hands, and the middle part pops out.
Right.
So that's, you know, a oblate spheroid is, you know, to use the jargon for it. If you then use your ruler to then kind of measure it from the pole over to the equator, it will change in size. It will be a different size.
Yes.
And so the trick is, how do you spin your telescope around? And so the one trick you can do is, if you look in certain parts of the sky, the Earth actually just does this for you. So if you, say, look at the North Pole, if you look at the North Star, let's say, you can actually then just over the course of the night, as the Earth rotates, if your two telescopes are along an east-west line, they will appear to spin on the sky. It's a lot like if you are standing on a merry-go-round and you're looking up at an airplane, let's say, and your friend pushes you and it starts to spin, the airplane will appear to rotate.
Yes.
So you can do that. So that's kind of the cheap way to do it. The other way to do it is just go buy a third telescope. And then at that point, you have three rulers that are kind of pasted on the sky because you have between one and two and two and three and three and one.
Yeah.
Each one of those gives you a measurement. And then you can say, oh, well, it's kind of wide here on number one and two, but it's not as wide here between two and three or three and one. Why is that? And so what's really fun is then all the science comes out of that. And most people, I think correctly, would expect that a star is going to be round. You know, how do you get a star that's not round? It seems kind of actually kind of really weird, maybe a little unsettling. But what it is actually there are some stars that spin real fast. And they spin so fast that they're really actually trying to rip themselves apart. So, for example, our sun does not do this. Our son is...
Well, that's good.
Our son, thanks for the good news.
Our sun goes... It actually has a bit of spin. You can actually, if you look at the sun, you can see spots on the surface of the sun every now and then. It takes about 30 days for the sun to rotate once.
Okay.
And there are other stars. There's one in the sky called Altair. And that was the first one we measured like this. That is about twice as big as the sun.
Wow.
But okay. It spins every 12 hours. And so,
whoa.
Yeah.
Where's, like, how? I mean, I'm just thinking this, how the massive amount, how does that thing that big spin that fast?
Well, so I actually like to turn the question on its head and ask the question, why don't all stars spin that fast?
Okay.
Because our understanding of how stars form is that they coalesce out of very, very large clouds of dust and gas, mostly gas.
Right.
That is, say, 10 or 100 or 1,000 times the size of our solar system when they're first getting born. And so then the gravity will kick in and it'll kind of pull all this material down. But you have what we call conservation of angular momentum. The spin is conserved.
Yes.
So if you think of an ice skater, is out there on the Olympic ice and they're going for their big finish. They always have this at the finish. They start off with the spin and they have their arms out and their legs out. And then they pull in their arms and legs. And they, what do? They start spinning faster and faster.
Right.
Yes.
Because conservation of angular momentum. And stars, when they're born, you only maybe have the tiniest amount of spin in this nursery, in this bubble of baby star.
Okay.
But it all pulls into the center and it starts to spin up real fast.
Wow.
And so some of these stars just never slow down. So most of them do, and we get things like the sun, but some of them don't slow down and you get things like Altair.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and it's about 20% wider at its equator than it is tall.
Oh, and, wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That's a lot.
It's really noticeable. Yeah.
That's a lot. Okay, so continuing while you're going with this.
Yeah.
Scientifically, why is it important for us to understand and learn the shapes of stars and things out in space?
Well, this is really useful. These, in general, we want to know about stars because we happen to be wedded to one. That's very important to us.
Yes.
But it's very hard, let's say, to understand the sun if all we study is the sun. We get to see the sun in exquisite detail,
mm-hmm.
but if all we did was study the sun, we would miss out on all kinds of other interesting physics and other kinds of interesting ideas, and we would miss out on a lot of understanding about our own sun. I always try to compare that to, you know, imagine if you're a doctor and you're trying to understand, you know, the entire range of human condition and malady and disease.
Yes.
Kind of thing.
Okay.
But in med school, you get to study exactly one case, one patient.
Right.
You would miss out on half of the genders just like that, for starters. But
right.
then on top of that, yeah, you know, you would miss out on either tall people or short people if you're measuring it. Yeah, so all that kind of thing. So in the case with stars, you want to study a lot of stars because that lends to our understanding of how stars work. These ones that spin real fast are kind of cool because they give you a handle on not just what is happening at the surface of the star, but they give you a handle on what's happening inside the star because they're really trying to rip themselves apart. And so they give you a much more wide view of how the star could look both at the surface on the inside because you kind of see a bit of everything going from the equator to the pole.
Wow.
So it's kind of cool.
Wow. That is very cool.
That is very cool.
And as you were describing it, I went back to your analogy of being able to see an orange in New York from Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And I used the orange stuck in my brain. And I was thinking about if our sun was an orange, you don't know enough about an orange unless you learn about other fruits. and just how much science and understanding we get doing those comparisons of things that are both similar and dissimilar.
That's right. You'd miss out on limes and lemons and my martini wouldn't look right. And
So having figured this out, is there a new project that you are working on at your awesome facility? Are you trying to figure out shapes of other stars or is there something else you've moved on to work on?
So we're doing more of that, more of the same with looking at more stars and trying to get a sense for what are things that you can see with the different shapes of stars.
Okay.
But the kind of the next level down, you know, as you peel the onion, you have more and more layers.
Yeah, sure.
When you get good at measuring not just the size of a star, but then the shape of the star, you really want to know what the star looks like. And so I'd say the next big horizon out there is measuring spots on stars.
And oh, okay.
That's right. So we see this on our sun. We see spots that come and go.
Right.
And these are really cool. They have about an 11-year cycle. And so over the course of the 11 years, you get a lot of spots to periods of time where there aren't as many spots. And those are connected to how magnetic fields appear in the sun.
Yes.
And the sun's like a giant dynamo, a giant magnet. And those magnetic fields affect how it shines sometimes.
Right.
And so we want to know about that more for the sun, but we also want to know about these for these other stars. And so, you know, here we get into the case of not just seeing that orange in New York City, but you want to read I off the sun kiss that's written on the orange.
Okay.
And so we're building more and more capable telescopes that can do this kind of thing. And so the way you do that is you have even bigger and bigger arrays that aren't necessarily the size of a football field, but more like the size of, you know, something that's maybe a mile across.
Wow.
Wow.
What's a thing that's a mile across? Anyway, and so, yeah, you need things that are bigger and bigger and more telescopes being thrown into the mix that are synthesizing the single large telescope.
I'm curious, how long does this take for you to measure the size and the shape? So you take images, but then I'm assuming all of this data comes via computer and then has to be processed. And
so there is the time that goes into making the observation. Mm-hmm. And this is usually a few nights on the telescopes. It's actually not that, it's not like, you know, years and years on end of observing,
even
months on end. It's actually pretty reasonable in terms of observing time. But then as far as reconstructing the image, if you have all the software that can do that sort of thing, it also takes a few days. The rub is that a lot of times we're still inventing this kind of technology.
Oh.
And so you got to figure out how to write the code, and that will take months. And then, so there's a surprising amount of desk work that goes into being an astronomer in terms of, you know, I'm just sitting here writing code. And so there's a lot of that going on. You know, there's not a lot of, there's less than people might think of, you know, being out on the frosty night and staring into the heavens.
So. I love that you went into that Carl Sagan voice doing that as well. But at least sitting where you are, being the chief scientist where you are with Lowell Observatory, it sounds like you are able to, being right at that sort of tip of the spear, you're able to work on creating software that you want to use next.
That's fabulous.
Which sounds very cool.
Yeah, I do much more software engineering than I ever had schooling for.
Okay.
That's okay. We have lots of scientists and engineers who come on the show and then they do stuff like you. They just were like, well, I want to do this, but there's nothing that, so I guess I'll just invent it is what happens.
And that's kind of fun, actually. I really like and enjoyed that aspect of there's a challenge there, but kind of a certain excitement. And in the end, you get to be the first person to see something from time to time.
Wow.
That's very cool.
That's going to
be very
cool.
So before Ms. Jen moves us along, I have to ask one question that I want to get onto the show.
Yeah.
With you being probably the most high-profile, smartest astronomer that I know personally.
Okay.
I love looking at the sky and to deal with it. I love looking at the sky. I know things I like to look at, but with the capabilities that you have and how much work you do in astronomy, is there an ideal project? Is there something that you still want to work on before your career is done?
There is actually something very much I'd like to punch on my bucket list. And that is with these capabilities of seeing stars at high resolution.
Right.
One of the things that we've discovered a lot of in the field in the last 25 years or so is planets that are going around other stars.
Exoplanets.
And so exoplanets are hard to study because they are sitting next to this super bright nuclear inferno. And all you get is a little bit of reflected light from the planet. But there's a trick that we do in astronomy where right now astronomy has been doing this without actually, again, seeing the stars as more than a point of light.
Right.
But one of the things we do is for some of these cases where there's a planet and it's orbiting that star,
right,
you can actually see from time to time that the star appears to get a little dimmer. And then after a few hours, it brightens back up. And it's not a lot. It's maybe 1% dimmer. And a lot of times it's even a much, much smaller fraction than that. And so what is happening is the orbit just happens to have aligned up in that particular system that, you know, every few days or every few months or so, when the planet happens to go between us and that host star, you get a little dip in brightness.
Right.
And so there are many thousands, literally thousands of exoplanets that have been found around other stars just by looking for this dip in brightness. So that's cool. Now, if you take that idea and you marry it to the sort of things that I do, which is let's take a star and let's actually jack up the resolution, you know, turn the zoom on steroids,
right?
See the disk of the star, then you should be able to actually see, make a movie of the disk of the star and then see a little shadow going in front of it.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we haven't done that yet because you actually do need to basically be able to see spots on stars at this point. And we're, as a community, we're only just starting to do that kind of thing for kind of a few of the easy cases. And
okay.
to extend it enough so that we can have enough stars that we can then include in that list of targets some that have planets as well and have the planets that just happen to line up. That requires a bit more work, but it's really on the tip of our tongue.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
That is very cool.
Humans are so cool. You know, I mean, we are so curious that we just figure out ways to learn what we want to learn, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
That's what I think is so amazing about every scientist and engineer that comes on our show. You guys all just, you get very curious. And you're like, I've learned this, which is amazing, but now I want to know that.
Yep.
Right? Like, I'm not done. And then once you learn that, then you want to know the next thing.
It's
very, very cool. Very cool. So yes, unfortunately, we are at that time in our show where we ask about the challenges, but that means that we're done talking about astronomy. But I'm curious to find out what your amazing challenge will be for our listeners, Dr. Gerard.
So my challenge is relating to how we build these telescopes, which is we have lots of mirrors. We have literally between the sky and the actual electronic detector, there's about 20 reflections of
light
bouncing off of mirrors. And in some cases, we're throwing the light a long ways, you know, hundreds of feet. And so the challenge is, can you, dear listener, align a mirror? And the way we're going to do this is you need two things. You need a bathroom with a mirror on the wall.
Okay.
And then separate from that, you need a second little hand mirror.
Okay.
And what I want you to do is I want you to go to the bathroom and go into the bathroom and look at the mirror on the wall and then take the hand mirror and put it up against your head. So the hand mirror is the shiny part is facing the shiny part of the mirror on the wall, and then look straight ahead at the mirror on the wall. And off of that mirror, you should be able to see the hand mirror next to your head. And then look into that hand mirror, and you're going to be tipping it and tilting it. And I want you to then align that hand mirror so that when you look into the hand mirror, you see the mirror on the wall again. You see the hand mirror again. So basically, you're doing two reflections back and forth between this. And then as you get better and better, you can actually tip and tilt that little hand mirror so you can actually see 3, 4, 5 reflections of yourself in that. And I was able to get up to 6, maybe 7 reflections.
That's so cool.
Dr. Gerard already tried this for
us. We were playing with that last night. My kids and I were playing with that last night. And so do that. And then if you want to get really advanced, there's another riff on top of that, which is you're going to need what you already have. But then on top of that, go get a small flashlight and put the mirror up against your head again, the hand mirror. And then also kind of at the top there, stick the flashlight right kind of in the crook between your head and that hand mirror, and then try to turn off the lights and then try to see how many times you can line up the flashlight.
Okay.
And
so I found that was, I tried that out last night as well. I found that that was harder to align, but it was easier to see the reflections, and I could get maybe 10 reflections all 1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh, okay.
They're easier to count. And so that's your challenge, is to see if you can align a mirror. And if you can, I will stick you in pipes out here at the lab.
You're hired, right?
That's right. That's right.
I love it.
That's fabulous. I love this. I hope all of our listeners try this. This has been a fabulous episode. I have learned so much. Thank you so much for being on Solve It for Kids, Dr. Gerard.
Thank you, Dr. Gerard.
It's been a delight, Jennifer, Jeff. I loved it.
Awesome.
Wow. Now I feel like I know exactly how Dr. Gerard and his team are doing something that I never had even thought of figuring out the sizes and shapes of stars, because I know how far away they are and I know just how difficult that kind of work would have been.
I mean, it's just every time we have guests on like this, Jeff, I'm just so stunned. Right? Like, the humans can come up with all of these amazing things, and if there isn't engineering or science that allows them to do it, they invent it, right?
Yes. And the fact that our guests can share such incredible engineering and scientific processes in a way that all of us can understand, so the next time we all look up at stars, guess what we're going to be thinking about? I wonder what shape that star is.
I mean, I'm definitely going to do that. And his challenge is so cool. Everybody needs to do that.
We have all done this mirror next to the mirror thing and seeing, you know, we all like, so I can see infinity. But how many of us have ever actually counted just how many reflections you are getting and then making it a challenge to see in your household who can get the most reflections in those two mirrors that you can actually count. Very cool, Dr. Gerard.
I know. Oh, I love that. And so, of course, me, I'm like, when I do this, I wonder also, could you take a picture of yourself with all of the little gens up here, right? That's another challenge. You guys could add that. So anybody that does that, make sure you let us know. Tag us on our social media. We are at KidSolve at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And also, don't forget to check out our website, solveitforkids.com, where we will have information about Lowell Observatory, Dr. Van Bell, and at the end of every page on our website, we recommend books that kids can check out to learn more about space and all of this amazing stuff.
Because we really do want you to listen to these episodes and then continue that learning after the episode is over. Because it's not just learning, it is fun as well. And as if all of us needed another reason to keep looking up, Dr. Gerard just gave us one. Think about the shapes of stars. Until next time, you'll hear us on
Solve It for Kids.